Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Joined today by Jeff Frazier. Jeff comes to us from a background of being an entrepreneur, a missionary, and has an awesome story that we would like to share. Jeff, welcome to True Crime Cast.
Thanks for having me, Jamie. Thanks, John.
I don't feel like my introduction did justice. So why don't you tell us more about yourself and what you're involved with?
That's kind of you. I don't need to be highfalutin about nothing, but you're right. I come from a business background. I kind of think of myself as like a baby Bill Gates, right? Like I have nowhere near that kind of money, but I did have a lot of success in business and then really got a heart for humanitarian stuff. And so that's my thing now. Since 2019 is when I sold the controlling stake in my clinical research company. And then really just focused on Haiti, moved my family from California to South Florida and started going to Haiti about twice a month, learn the language, that whole deal.
How did the family respond to that move? Were they all on board or was there some coaxing there?
No, they were totally on board. They're really good kids. The older one, you know, we're huge churchy people, right? And we really like to pray, and we prayed as a family together about the whole thing. And you know, the old kids who are old enough to really get that process were super invested, and it was a great experience for everybody. Some bumps and bruises when we got here, you know, kids getting ripped out of their schools, that kind of thing, but they were on board. That's great. But that's a very sensitive question, John. Thanks for asking.
Well, how old are your kids, or how old were they at the time when this decision was made?
So right now, my oldest is actually serving a mission in Indiana, Haitian Creole speaking, coincidentally. She's 19, just about to turn 20. And then the youngest of our adopted children from Haiti, he is four.
Awesome.
And pretty much every age in between.
Yeah, that's quite the range.
Not sure. There's 10 of them. So we have 7 biological children and 3 adopted children.
I thought Jamie had a lot of kids. Jamie has 4.
That is a lot.
Two adopted and 2 bio, and I have 2 and work in the adoption field. So
I don't know if you
knew that coming into this or not. But
yeah, no, that's great. That's great. Where did your adoption take place, domestically or international?
Yeah, it was through the foster care system in the state of Kentucky. That's where we live. So yeah,
fantastic.
Foster to adopt both of our youngest ones. And 4 feels like a lot. They are both in 5th grade right now.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Good for you.
Yeah. So many kids. And so I assume that a lot of the adoptions from Haiti came after you started doing your work there. What was it about Haiti that led you there in particular?
Yeah, that's a good question. So circa 2014, I got involved with an organization that's now called Our Rescue. They focus on rescuing child sex slaves from around the world. And so in 2014, I became aware of that scourge, which absolutely stunned me, right, to even realize that that was a thing and that children were being sold for sex. And I spent probably 2 weeks just kind of in a daze walking around, just not knowing what I could do or should do. And just, I call it the puke phase.
Yeah.
And then eventually came out the other end and decided to get to work. I didn't have any money at the time to donate to the cause, but I did have a tiny little tech firm / ad agency that we made websites, right, to promote things. And so we raised our hand and volunteered and made most of their initial websites and marketing materials, that kind of thing. And so just did all that pro bono for years. And so I was, as I was getting ready to retire, in effect, I had become more and more active with that organization and was really trying to be more operational. And when I got close to retiring, I approached the founder and said, "Hey, you know, I want to get more involved. What do you think?" And he said, "Yeah, I would really love it if you went and solved this Haiti Rubik's Cube," right? Like, because Haiti, we had had so much success in other countries around the world with fighting child sex slavery. And Haiti, we could never really get our foot in the door, right? We do one op, and then the government agencies that we were working with would just kind of disappear. Either the guy would get fired or replaced, or there's some sort of issue in the government changeover, or they would die. Like, it was all these kind of dramatic things that were happening. We could just never get much momentum. So he asked me to go kind of go down there and kind of learn it, figure it out. And in the process of doing that, I just fell in love with the country and started to recognize that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere by a significant margin, but it ought not. And there's a litany of reasons why it ought to be doing much better than it is. And I wanted to figure out why and see what I could do to contribute to bringing that country forward.
I have a lot of questions, but I'll start here. So many people hear about problems and they're like, their attitude is, oh man, that sucks. Somebody should do something about that. You heard of a problem and you were like, man, that sucks. How can I fix this? What makes you built like that versus so many other people who are just like, somebody else will fix that problem?
That's a good question. If my wife were sitting here, she'd say that it's because of my supreme arrogance that makes me think that I can actually make a difference. And that it's probably arrogance mixed with optimism. You know, that's that same thing that makes you a good entrepreneur, right? We jump into salt. So my clinical research company, that was built because I wanted to answer every human biological question. Yeah. I realized that we actually know very little about human biology, and I wanted to fix that, right? And, you know, that's absurd, right, to go and try to fix that. But what it's the whole shoot for the moon, hit the stars, or shoot for the stars, hit the moon thing. That was what we did in business, where we saw this ideal that we wanted to try to shoot for. And so what business can get us a little bit closer to that spectacular idea of knowing everything about human biology? Well, it's the same thing in Haiti. You know, that I would love for Haiti to be this shining city on a hill. But in the process of doing that, you can fail dramatically at making it a huge prosperous nation and do a whole lot for what I call the critically poor or critical poverty. Those are people who are starving to death, right? They are so poor that they need to get something to eat or drink, or they're going to die. And Haiti has a staggeringly large number of people, especially children, that are in that category. And so while I probably will never live to see Haiti be a first world nation, I certainly can solve that critical poverty layer, right? Because it's a relatively small portion of the population, but it's still a staggeringly large amount of people. And you only have to lift them a little bit, right? The delta between poor enough that you have dirt floors, which is fine, right? It's not ideal, but it's fine. Poor enough to have dirt floors, but not so poor that you're selling your kids.
Yeah.
Right. That gap is, you know, a couple of percentage points, right? You can just get enough food in your belly that you don't sell your kids. That's what I'm shooting for. And that's a fairly realistic goal. There's a handful of dials that we need to crank in the right direction in Haiti. And my organization, Stimpak, has done a lot of good work to understand what those dials are. And we're excited to turn them in the next few years.
Tell us more about Stimpak and maybe what some of the dials are that you focus on.
Thank you for asking. So like I mentioned, started in the anti-child trafficking space. But once you realize you have to lift a whole country, you got to learn about a lot more than just child exploitation, right? Sure. And there's somewhere between 200,000 and 800,000 children who are abandoned in Haiti currently. So I know that's a wide range, and that's because definitions of an abandoned child vary depending on the organization that you're considering. But so, for example, I was in somewhere near the border of Haiti a few years ago, and we were planting a nursery. So we had bought land and we were planning to plant hundreds of thousands of fruit trees in Haiti, right, for the obvious benefit of food. Mm-hmm. And they've got a big deforestation issue. So we're not just replanting trees or replanting fruit trees that can provide not just money, but also food, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in the process of of building the nursery that was going to grow all those trees. There were young boys hanging out that wanted work, right? They wanted to help us build this nursery, start planting these trees. And I looked over to one stack of kids over in the corner who were waiting. And one of the boys was really young, maybe 10 years old, something like that. So I went over and engaged them and started to get their story. And that little boy told me his story of walking from his hometown, which was probably about 60 miles away, 60. Wow. And you know, his clothes were falling apart. He clearly was emaciated, and you know, this is a starving kid, right? There's no reason you walk 60 miles unless you're really desperate, right? Yeah. And that was this kid. And I remember trying to understand what would motivate him to do that, what would cause him to do that, and started to really understand what desperate critical poverty is. And obviously we did what we could to get that boy, you know, what he needed. But that's a perfect example. Is that an abandoned child? Because he has parents, he has family somewhere, right? They just can't provide for him, right? They provide no parental function to him, right? And so that's where that disparity between 200,000 and 800,000 come. Like, who do you define as abandoned child? But I forget what you, right. So how do we solve that, yeah, right? That was your original question. And so you'll have to listen to the podcast, especially season 3, to really get educated on that. But the long and short of it is you need to help people economically, mm-hmm, right? And there's 1,000 ways to try to assist them economically. We have this saying at Stimpac, GNBO, that's give nothing but opportunity. Mm-hmm. So you don't want people on the dole. You don't want to steal people's dignity by over giving. You don't want to demotivate them by turning them into beggars. You know, all those kinds of issues that become central to some of our approaches. But there's a lot of ways that you can give that are opportunity. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
I could talk for days on that.
Sure.
Yeah. It's an interesting approach to me when I consider it, because I think if I were in your shoes motivated to act, I would want to take the approach of find the people buying these children and trafficking them and take them down. You know, but you're coming in and empowering families to take care of themselves so they never have to face that decision, you know. Are there organizations that are investigating who these people are that are providing these families money for children and working at it from that angle too?
Yeah. So that's our rescue. So that's the nonprofit. I'm actually on the board at that nonprofit. Mm-hmm. That's the nonprofit to which I referred initially that kind of got me into Haiti. Right. Mm-hmm. So Stimpac, which is my NGO, I just developed that a few years ago. So before that, I was coming in doing exactly that. So rescuing kids from child sex slavery. And that's actually working with law enforcement to put people in, bad guys in jail, right? But it doesn't take long to rescue a handful of kids to see that there's 10 kids right behind that one that you just rescued that will fill that demand, right? Because the supply is nearly limitless of people who are willing to sell their virtue, right? Because they're not willing to lose their lives. And so some of us might judge that decision, but you know, I judge very slowly in those environments. But yes, right? And so we're trying to hit it from the other end, right? The preventative side.
Yeah. And while I don't want to take anything away from what you're doing in Haiti, it's a problem that happens here in America too.
That's right.
I work in Kentucky and I serve for the social services department in Kentucky. And I've heard of this happening here.
Absolutely.
I had a child attempted to be sold at a dollar store for $5,000. And so, yeah, it's not a problem that's just in Haiti or third world countries. It's happening in your neighborhoods. So
absolutely. Yeah. If you go to ourrescue.org, that you'll see we're all over the world, including in the U.S. Much of our work is within the U.S. You'd be shocked. It's down the street. We used to do this demonstration with a piece of software. I forget who provided that software. It was not ours. Where at our fundraiser, we would try to explain to people, hey, this is happening around you. And the software would track CSAM. Forget what that acronym stands for. Child sexual exploitation material, mm-hmm. CSAM. sexual assault material. And the tech would track actual files that are being traded, right, between computer to computer. And you can pull up a map, and we would put it on the overhead screen, and the map would show a little ping, a little burst on the screen anytime CSAM was traded from one computer to another, right? Mm-hmm. And we would put up the map of their neighborhood, right? Their city, wherever we were doing that fundraiser. And by the time the presentation was over, that map was full of dots, right? In real time, those files were being traded all over their area, right? There's lots of bad guys to be had. And so what we would do is we'd find concentrations of those files and where those were being originated, and presume that that's where the bad guy is actually creating this CSAM mm-hmm. material. And so you can go and get those bad guys.
Yeah.
I think it's safe to assume that the bad guys know about you and your work. And I think our fans would be disappointed in us if we didn't ask you how much has that affected you personally?
So I don't look at CSAM. I'm not one of our heroes that does that very heavy work. I'm just a volunteer, and I'm on the board. And luckily, we have really good support systems around those people who have to actually look at the CSAM. But yeah, it's very heavy on them. And you've got one of the women on our board, her job for the state of Washington is to take care of the law enforcement personnel who do have to look at this CSAM on a regular basis, and figuring out how to keep them healthy, right? Keep them refreshed, keep them on rotation. They get to meet with therapists, and there's all sorts of help buttons that they can hit, that kind of thing. But these are heroes that go in there, and sometimes they get burned, and they messes with their brains, and we got to heal them up. But it's a scary thing, but we need them to do that work.
Yeah.
To do that work.
And I know that's not the boots on the ground work you do, but you have done a lot of boots on the ground work in Haiti and have had your share of trouble. And we know that you spent time in captivity. You were kidnapped. And I know you cover that extensively kind of day by day in the Stimpak podcast, but kind of give us a summary of what led to you being taken captive. And yeah, I mean, we obviously don't have 3 days to sit here and talk through all of it I'm going to listen and hear the whole story, but tell us that story.
Sure. Thanks for asking. So I mentioned GNBO, right? Give nothing but opportunity. That's a cute kind of fancy little term for, hey, let's have long-term solutions in Haiti. Those kinds of solutions start to look really trite when the country's fallen apart. Mm-hmm. And in 2021, the Haitian president was assassinated. And that began a downward slide of that country that brought it to the point where we're at now, where the country's controlled by probably 90% of the capital is run by gangs. Right? It's totally owned by them. They often will control the port in Port-au-Prince, with the inflow of food and fuel and water and all of that into the country. And they can terrorize in all sorts of ways. And so they'll kidnapping is one of their biggest things. Yeah. But that terror drives up prices for everything, including food, the fuel that they use to pump water out of the ground, right? Their wells. And so that creates instant critical need for people who are going to die very quickly, right? If you don't have water, they start to die very fast. And then you get the spread of cholera, which had been happening. So when I was kidnapped in 2023, I had shifted from these more long-term economic solutions to issues in Haiti to, hey, let's just deliver food and water, right? And cooking oil, right? Let's try to help some of these people from dying, like right now.
Right.
Right. And so, I don't know anything about distributing food. And so we had to learn that, mm-hmm. right? Kind of on the job. But we were going into the areas where the World Food Program couldn't or wouldn't go. And a lot of those are gang controlled areas. And so we would make deals with these gangs to go in, and for the most part, they were grateful for it, right? They would kind of take credit for it. And some of these areas, the gangs kind of operate as the mayor, right? A dictator mayor, right? But he still got to provide some sort of services for his people. And so, you know, they would pretend like my food was their food, but I don't care, right? I'm just trying to feed them. And then there's other areas that are free areas, but you have to go through gang controlled areas with your truckload of food to get there. Mm-hmm. And so we were doing that. So we drove from Port-au-Prince through an area called Martissant that's just west of the capital, and it's totally gang controlled. And there's a toll booth of sorts, and that makes it sound fancier than it was. It's like a blue umbrella and two guys underneath with, you know, AR-15s,
yeah,
AK-47s, that kind of thing. And then floating kind of gang members around there. But you have to pay, you know, at that booth. We had already made an arrangement ahead of time through my security guys, had made a deal with this gang to go through. And so we did. And we were successful. We got through there and we're able to go to this place called Jacmel, which is a free area where there are not gangs still to this day. And we did our food distribution down there. It was great. It was very successful. We were on our way back. We had to go through that very same area. And for whatever reason, the gang couldn't resist the temptation and they took us then. So we drove past that toll booth, made it maybe a half a mile past it. And then we're surrounded by a bunch of motorcycles with two guys on each motorcycle. They jumped in. Well, first one guy looks through the driver's window and sees me in the back because the windows were tinted and up, kind of hiding me, so to speak. As soon as he sees me in the back, he waves the rest of them to get in the truck. And so the driver tells my driver to scoot over, and he kind of sits on the center console and smashes up against the ceiling. And then a guy puts stacks mine and my other guy's luggage in between us. I'm sitting in the back seat on the passenger side, and he gets into the vehicle, and then he's got an M16. He puts my hat over my eyes, like to cover my eyes so I won't see where we're going. And I'm able to slide my head kind of underneath that hat so that I can still see out the window, because I want to track where we're going. I start counting the lefts and rights as we go away from the main road, but I quickly lose track, sure. lose count because the adrenaline's pumping, you know. And we get up to this, we go inside this compound. It's got, you know, probably 15-foot high walls with the razor wire and whatnot. It clearly used to be some sort of a seminary mm-hmm. campus, but it's nice on the inside comparatively. You know, it's all concrete and shanty towns on the outside, tin roofs, that whole thing. But once you go inside here, it's freestanding buildings, and they're, you know, 100 feet apart from each other, which is unheard of in this area, right? It's so spacious. But we go up to the top of the hill, the top of this compound, and they let us out. They stick us in one of these buildings. They pat us down, still covering my eyes, pat us down for valuables, and then show us into this concrete cell with the, you know, iron bars. And that would be my home for the next 43 days.
What did they want? Why were, you know, was there like a, did they want money for your exchange? Was that kind of the deal?
Yeah, no, that's always their deal. Yeah, they just want ransom. That's their business. They're in the business of pillage.
For you, and you said they looked in the back seat and saw you. Were the individuals in the front seat Haitian? Is it because you weren't from there that they identified you as somebody they could maybe get some value financially out of?
Yeah, no. And you know, after spending 6 weeks in gang controlled territory, you start to realize how much we stuck out like a sore thumb, right? Yeah. Even my Haitian security guys and, you know, kind of local guides, they stuck out. Like you can just spot them once you understand what gang members look like and what the acceptable traveler, you know, looks like. You know, had I been at that toll booth, I would have spotted us. So, you know, even with me hiding in the back, it was clear that we weren't locals.
So you're there for 43 days, which is insane that obviously that this happened, but to be held captive for that long. So what was the process like of them trying to get some ransom, negotiating that, and what was your life like in captivity?
So I think what we think of when you hear about kidnappings is we think about the movies, right? Yeah. We think that the FBI is going to show up with their capes on and they're going to set up, you know, a command center in your living room and until you're free. And that might be true in the US, but when you're in a level 4 do not travel country like Haiti, it's, and I knew that going in, sure. Right? It's very clear on the website, and they make sure you know that you're going into a terrible place and you're on your own, right? And so I knew we would be on our own. But what I think, I feel terrible about is I made those risks on my own, not realizing that my wife was going to be paying the price,
sure,
for rescuing me. Right. And so she gets this call the night of, I think it was probably around 9 o'clock at night. And if you listen to the day one episode, you get the actual time.
And no offense to you, but her telling the story of her telling your kids is what emotionally wrecked me. So yeah, your wife got the call. How did they figure out who to call? Did you have a phone on you? Did you have ID? Did you give them a number?
Yeah. So when I got my phone for the first time, so we were taken right around lunchtime, and then by six or so, they've made demands to me and, you know, gunpoint, the whole, you know, kind of scary thing. Mm-hmm. And then I get my phone around 6:30, something like that, in the evening. And my first phone call is actually to this guy who I call Bill. Mm-hmm. And Bill and I had worked together quite a bit down there in getting in and out of these gang areas. I had done some food distribution with him. He's a long time dude down in Haiti. He's lived in Haiti for 10 years, that kind of thing. But he had claimed to have a lot of inroads with all of these gangs. And so my first call was to him, like, hey, you got to get out of jail free card for me. Right. Mm-hmm. Cause I know all these gangs are connected, right? Sure. They're not necessarily aligned, but they all know each other. Right. Mm-hmm. At least these big ones. And I knew I was in with this big one called Tilapli.
Yeah.
And so that was my first call, was to him. And then I gave him the phone number of one of my other buddies, and said, hey, can you call this guy? And I knew he would send out the bat signal, mm-hmm, to my family because he was connected to them.
Right.
Right. What he ended up doing is he thought that second phone number that I gave him was one of the kidnappers' phones. So he misunderstood it. I'm sure it's an intense phone call to receive.
Oh, yeah. Right?
And so some of the message was fuzzy. So all he did was call the embassy and gave the embassy that number. They were, because I was I'm an LDS bishop, and that guy, Bill, knew that I was an LDS bishop. He mentioned that to the embassy. The embassy contacted my wife through the church.
Okay.
So they got it.
Yeah. So talk more about her reaction, I guess. You can hear it on the podcast, but you say you knew the risk you were taking, but... And I guess she knew in theory something could happen to you, but the reality is very different.
Yeah, the reality is very different. Yeah. You know, if there was ever a movie made out of our story, it would be told from my wife's perspective, right? Yeah. We all love a good hero's journey, and she absolutely embodies that. Yeah. You know, she goes from, you know, being this mother of seven who's never really done anything adventurous. She had been down to Haiti before with me, one, maybe two times, but in very controlled environments, very safe places. We had been to some orphanages, you know, and in part of our adoption process, we went down there to understand that. But she's very much a stay-at-home mom, not overly exposed to the scary things of the world.
Sure.
And she's a bit of a worrywart, right? Like She's always assuming the worst thing is going to happen. The worst case is going to happen. And in our whole marriage, right? We've been married 20 years. Our whole marriage, I've always told her of the rational realities and unlikelihood that the worst case scenario is going to happen. And then here she is getting this worst case scenario phone call from the Haitian embassy, you know, and it took her a while to even verify if that phone call is real. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nobody at your door with a badge that they're showing. It's like, well, he said he was from the embassy, and then he said that the FBI was going to call me and give me some tips. But long story short, they basically told her, you got to put a team together. All right, this is going to be a private endeavor. This is not, the government isn't going to do anything for you. Right? They said if my wife could get me to a safe space like the Marriott Hotel, then they would give me a ride from the hotel to the airport, which is like a joke. Like,
that's the easy part.
If I could get that far, I could get to the airport. And I, that makes me sound like I'm vilifying the FBI. I'm not. They're great. They're doing what they can, what they're allowed to, what they're staffed for, right? But it's not helpful. And so my wife has to figure out, so what do you do? Like, what is that team? How do you put it together? How do you even hire that? How do you make sure that you're not getting scams? Because people come out of the woodwork, right? And now they want a piece of the action, right?
Yeah.
She spent, you know, the coming weeks, days and weeks putting that together and learning how to be a hostage negotiator. And because she led that team. Right. They, while she brought in experts and professionals that were awesome and trusted, many of them pro bono, right, that were taking good care of us, she's still got to make those mortal decisions, right? They're not going to, my life is in their hands, and these outsiders are not going to make those tough choices. And so every ridiculously difficult decision had to be made by my wife while, by the way, trying to take care of seven children at home. And that was before our adopted children had arrived, trying to take care of them and manage their mourning and their, you know, reactions to what's happening and all of that. But, you know, long story short, she figures it out. And on, I think it's day 35, I get on the phone with her. And I talked to her for the first time on like day three or something like that. But then I don't talk to her again until day 30 something, right? There's this huge gap in there where you're, the worst part about being captive is imagining how bad things are at home, right? Like on the outside. Like, you're miserable and you're having a hard time, but imagine your loved ones being horrified and terrified, right? Like, that's so much worse. Yeah. Right? And so that's what's really eating at you is like, I might get out of here, but what am I going home to?
Yeah.
Right? What kind of mess am I going to find there? And when I talked to her on the phone on that day 35-ish, it was incredible. She was this new power broker. Like, she gets on the phone and she's got very specific instructions for me. She's got a set of information she's trying to extract from me, and I'm trying to manage her on the phone, and she's having none of it. Right?
Like, yeah.
Like, this is what we're talking about. This is what you need to do. No, you can't do that. Yes, you, like that kind of stuff. And it was so awesome.
Yeah.
I got off the phone, off that call, and I was on cloud nine for like 24 hours, just like elated that my worst fears were not going to be the case. Now, absolutely, there's deep trauma, and you know, we go into that a lot on the podcast of, you know, what happened to her and me and our parallel experiences, all of that kind of stuff is of course true. Sure. But she didn't crumble. In fact, she became this incredible new greater thing. Right. My wife has always been powerful. She's always been amazing. Her power is what attracted me to her initially. Right. I of course love my wife. Right. But this new thing that she became after this horrific experience is something far greater that I just never could have imagined she would become as a result of this trauma.
That's awesome. I feel like depending on the day, my wife would say, have him, boys. He's yours. Yeah, but no, I'm kidding. But that's, man, that's powerful and that's incredible.
So, I mean, you joke, but that makes a lot of sense. I mean, my wife was told, especially as time went on while I was gone, like, hey, you should know most marriages don't make it through this. Wow. Right. And they didn't tell that to her, you know, to scare her, but rather to prepare her, like, hey, this is going to be messy when Jeff gets back. Yeah. Right. And luckily the opposite was true. We were absolutely fused together, but I can absolutely see why it would wreak havoc on a marriage, that kind of a situation.
Talk about the rescue or extraction. Like, how did you finally get free?
Yeah. So, I escaped on, day 28, the night of, or in the early morning hours of day 29, but then was recaptured later that day, that morning. Only made it maybe like a mile and a half away. So, you know, 10 hours later, I was back in my cell and yeah. Now much, much worse. Right? Sure. Like now they're going to make an example of me. And I escaped with one of my fellow captives. And, you know, we were wrecked after that. And of course, that's when the beatings and torture, you know, got terrible. Yeah. And so that time period between when I was recaptured to on day 29 to day 43 were just, you know, horrific. Yeah. But what prompted my escape was, well, one, I had it planned, but also it was a failed ransom attempt on day 28. So I was supposed to get out on day 28. And when they didn't let me out, that kind of triggered, like, well, you guys are never going to let me out. I'm going to mm-hmm. be here forever. I might as well give this a shot.
Yeah.
And so when I got out for real on day 43, it was a successful live exchange.
Okay.
You know, that's obviously making an incredibly long story short, but yeah, it was a live exchange.
And I'll say, you know, go listen to this podcast if you want to learn more, because it's, there's a lot of details that we just don't have time to get into today.
And, and you and your wife tell the story, as well as you can. Like, I'm sure over time there's been healing and all those kinds of things, but I'm sure even talking about it's got to be painful. So we appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you.
So have you been back to Haiti?
Not yet. You know, it's funny that, I shouldn't say funny, a bit ironic. On that trip where I was taken, the day before I was taken, the food distribution went really well. Mm-hmm. And the organization that we had put together of local Haitians to do the bulk of that work, right? We're talking hundreds of thousands of pounds of food, right? I'm not lifting all those sacks, right?
Right.
So the real work was done by our Haitian counterparts. And mm-hmm. so I had decided, you know what? I'm not really needed here. Right. We can keep doing this work without me in country. And obviously I decided that one trip too late. Right.
Yeah.
But we've continued to do work in Haiti. Some of those projects I've handed off to other organizations, that are better at it than me. Right. It's as we've kind of pioneered certain areas and certain solutions, right. We've handed those off. And then I'm really focused on, U.S. foreign policy toward Haiti. Right. I'm trying to get the international community to work with Haiti properly. Mm-hmm. Right. It's hard work, right? Understanding from a policymaker standpoint in DC, understanding exactly how they should be helping in Haiti is tough stuff, right? And if you don't understand the culture and the language, then you can get it wrong a lot of times. And I'm trying to make sure that we get it wrong less. And so most of my efforts are focused on trying to educate the American people on how to relate properly with Haiti.
I think most people would have thrown in the towel. So admirable that you continue to do this work. How could our listeners learn more about or contribute to or support the work being done?
Oh, thanks for asking. So primarily come on and listen to season 2 of the podcast. Okay. So season 2 is all about the kidnapping story. We call it the 43 Days to Freedom series. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to 43 Days to Freedom, I think it's 18 episodes, right? And it's all true crime stories, right? Hopefully your listeners will be intrigued in that. If you listen to day 1, and you're not interested in it, then you're not going to be. But the vast majority of the people, I think it's like 80%. If you listen to day 1, you binge the whole
thing,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like 15 hours of content. It's a lot. I don't know what it is, but it's a lot. But people binge it, right? Which is great. I'm honored that they spend time engaging with our story. But at the end of that season, is where we begin, which we're doing this now. We're now in season three. We begin to educate our listeners on now what? Like, how can we help? How do we lift Haiti out of this? How do we free these captive Haitians from this terror that they're living under with these gangs? What can we do? How do we dig in? So that's really what that's about. So come and get educated, hopefully get inspired by the story and by my wife and by many heroes that come to my rescue. I am truly inspired by them. I imagine that our listeners are as well.
Awesome. Well, we were honored to have you on today, and thank you so much for sharing your story. And we will put a link to your show in our comments or in our show notes so everybody can find it.
In the meantime, where could they find, is there a social media presence? Where could they get live updates while they're binging of what's going on?
Sure. So all of your relevant links are going to be on stimpack.org. That's STIMPACK.org. So that's our website. And then there's lots of link choices from there. So you'll see the links for 43 Days to Freedom and the podcast and social media. Most of our social media stuff is stimpack_Haiti.
Okay. So great. Well, we'll put those links.
We'd love
in
to
there.
See all you guys on there.
We'll put that link in there as well, Jeff. We really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story, and wish you the best of luck in your continued efforts to change the world.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Let's do it together, huh?
Listen to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.